Whither can you flee if your heart's fierce and ardent desire is to never hear the word Trinity? No need to descend to the depths of Sheol. Just go to any church of your choosing on Trinity Sunday. Any, that is, except St. John the Divine. Every seminarian's worst nightmare. The wake-up shaking in a cold sweat sort of nightmare is to be assigned to preach on this Sunday. I was sitting with Alistair and Archbishop Shane Parker, our primate, in the cathedral last Thursday when they reminded me that I would be preaching on Trinity Sunday. And I naively but enthusiastically piped up, "Oh, I have a few things to say about the Trinity." And Shane responded with a mischievous smile, "Any of it not heretical?" Well, you can be the judge. Although St. John the Divine is not known for being densely populated with senior officers from the heresy police. Truth be told, the Trinity is an article of faith that most Christians no longer connect with or care much about. An obscure matter of ancient dogma with little ongoing relevance. And when Christians do tangle with it, the Trinity is treated as a matter of conceptual speculation. How can three be one and one yet three? A total snooze fest. But God is not a puzzle to be solved, but a love in which we must swim. A love that we must become. If the notion of Trinity does not equip us for the work of becoming love, then it would be better for the word to be stricken from our tongues and our memory. No word about God can be adequate unless it is spoken in a spirit of yearning and desire. The proper goal of all genuine theological speech is neither cognitive capture nor the erasure of doubt, but to deepen our mystery with intimacy. The Church's calling is not to enforce Trinitarian orthodoxy, but to deepen our immersion in the love of God. The Church Fathers knew this. Gregory of Nyssa, who helped draft the Nicene Creed, explicitly acknowledged that only circumscribed or bounded entities can be counted. One tomato, two tomatoes, three tomatoes. So he explicitly insists that you cannot do math with the infinite. And yet, he also affirms, nonetheless, we must say three. To speak rightly about the Trinity, we must start with the heart, rather than seek to puzzle out ideas with the brain. God is our heart's deepest desire, so we must begin there and never stray far from the heart's terrain. Even then, our speech about God will falter. After all words fall short of the infinite. But they will not fail. A word spoken with yearning will always reach the infinite beloved's tender heart. But isn't Trinity the headiest of doctrines? How can we begin from the heart when speaking about the Trinity? To answer these questions, we must ask why the Church first felt compelled to speak in threefold terms. The answer, in short, is love. We begin with experience. A small group of first century Jews encountered a mystery, a flesh and blood human whom they knew intimately, whose mother they knew, a person they broke bread and traveled with. In this very person from the provincial town of Nazareth, they met a love that defied the telling. They encountered in him a ferocity and intensity of love unlike any they had encountered before, with one single exception. A love that embraced all radically and exhaustively, a love that knew no limit or boundary. No one was excluded from the ambit of the Nazarene's love. The fearsomely diseased, he embraced them. The despised Samaritan stranger, yes, by all means, Jesus loved them too. The poor most of all, because they most desperately need a love that reminds them of their infinite worth in a world that tries to convince them that they are worthless. The enemy? Yes, even the colonizing Roman enemy. Even the oppressor. He loved and healed them too and insisted that the disciples must become likewise. The entire prophetic tradition of Israel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, the whole lot of them seemed to live in him. Yes, he proclaimed the same message they did, but in him their ought became an is. He simply was what they proclaimed. If we could compare this man's capacity to love to one of those light bulbs that work on a gradient setting from dim to bright, his bulb seemed always to be at the brightest possible setting. Never before had any Jew encountered such love. Well, almost never, save in the Torah. In their holiest texts, they encountered a love that set Israel free from the conqueror's crushing grasp, a love that insisted on the preciousness of the alien, the widow, and the orphan, a love that claimed and even possessed God's weirdest, troubling, and eccentric servants, the prophets who thundered at them to embrace kindness, to do justice, and walk with humility. The covenant-making love of the one who had brought them out of Egypt set them free, but insisted that they were never to forget that they were once enslaved, so they would never again violate as they were once violated. That one, the one who now calls Israel his bride, his beloved, his people. In the bright and clarifying resurrection light of Easter morning, along the dusty road of Emmaus, as their hearts burned, the first Jesus followers came to one inescapable conclusion. In their beloved Master, God's very love had become enfleshed. Not something less than God's love, but God's love itself. They experienced themselves being recreated by the one who had created them in the first place. They also knew something else. They knew that they could not say that their beloved master and rabbi was God. They knew from their daily interaction with Jesus that he lived in constant communion with one whom he called Abba. He was not his Abba, but these two were utterly inseparable, distinct but not separate. Here we have the seeds of Trinitarian doctrine. The indissoluble unity of a single and self-same love, but experienced as coming to them from two distinct sources, from Jesus' Father and from Jesus himself. So indistinguishable was this single love that for early Christians and for us today, when we want to understand and experience the Creator's love, we turn to the face of Jesus. The Son's face becomes for us the way to see the Father's face. The mystery of our Mother, our Creator, finds tangible expression in Jesus' words and in Jesus' unrestricted embrace. But the mystery of the early Christian experience of God did not end with these two. If it did, we would need only to be Binitarians. It's a real word. Instead, those early Christians experienced something more, something utterly mind-defying. Love came to them yet again, in a form still more mysterious, so mysterious that they could only speak of it as a power, a force, a movement, a tongue of fire, a mighty rushing wind. The greatest mystery of all was that when this power took hold of them, love was no longer a reality over there or outside them. Instead, they became this love. They were filled with it. This love flowed within their hearts and inspired all their deeds. The Master's command to love radically, all-inclusively, justly, transgressively, love without fear, love neighbor and enemy alike, love across language, culture, creed, gender. That, now my heart beats with love's own rhythm. The love that first created me, the love that then recreated me through the Son, has now become in me an inspiring and perfecting love. In the power of this love, God is not just over there above me in the Creator or outside me in the Son's face, but now within me. The tender and rapturous love between the Father and the Son is not theirs alone. They do not hoard it, but that love has become in me, in us, a communicable wellness. The love with which the Father loves his beloved Son, that love claims me, claims us, and makes us over into love itself. We become by the Spirit's grace what God is by nature. We ourselves become love, and in so doing, we become God. We become divine. Without this third presentation of love, we would be left outside the tender and intimate drama between the lover and the beloved. We might be moved by their love and sing its praises, but it remains safely over there, a thing to be admired. We could not breathe it in. We could not be inspired and inspirited by it. The intimacy of the Son with the one whom he called Father, but we might call Mother, the deep, holy mystery, being itself, and so many other words. That intimacy would remain theirs alone. But the mystery of early Christian experience is that very intimacy entered the Christian community and made a church. The Spirit that hovered and brooded over the face of the deep in the beginningless beginning, she is now within us, around us, between us, filling us with the power to do what we had thought utterly beyond us, to speak truth to principalities and powers, find hope in an apparently hopeless circumstance, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, give birth to new words, new dreams, new possibilities, to love those whom we formerly regarded as unlovable. The lover, the beloved Son, our brother, and the Spirit, who is love itself. Their inseparable but utterly infectious communion. This communion has become ours. Our brother becomes ours in the bread and the wine. And we become the Spirit when she infuses our hearts. And in the power of the Son and the Spirit, we give ourselves to the deep mystery for whom and in whom and by whom we are created. This Trinity is what we celebrate today. May the Spirit, who is the love of the Father, Mother, and the love of the Son, enter our hearts and make us wholly over into love without remainder, so that we can love this precious world that so often and readily forgets that it is loved with an infinite love by which and for which it has been made. All we need is love. Bum, ba, da, da, bum. All we need is love, love. Love is all we need. Amen.